reality, every reader is, when he reads, the reader of his own self. The work of the writer is just a kind of optical instrument that is offered to the reader to permit him to discern that which, without the book in question, he could not have seen within himself. That was Marcel Proust in the final volume of his novel series, In Search of Lost Time. Philip Hensher's wonderful new book, A History of the Novel in Britain, is just such an optical instrument, but fitted to the story of the novel. It is a stylish and thrilling survey of an art form with its own nobility, its own grandeur. Readers will find much to discover here, along with a sharper sense of the strengths and flaws of the novels they might have read before. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and I am delighted that Philip joins me on the podcast today. So, you describe the story of the novel in Britain as a good story, but what makes the novel different to the prose stories that have been around for millennia?
Well, fiction had always been written in prose form, but I think it needed to find a root in a society of greater mobility than before. The prose fiction that comes before Robinson Crusoe, say, in English literature, it was very wedded to, firstly, to people's immutable place in society. So a prince in a prose romance, a 16th century prose romance, might be disguised as a shepherd, but his fundamental nature as a prince is always there. That emerges. The other thing that is very marked about pre-novelistic prose fiction is that there's very rarely any attempt to distinguish individuals as individuals. They speak, for instance, very much according to their status in life. If they're heroic figures, they talk in the same rolling perfect sentences. If they're urban or pastoral shepherds or some working class figure, then they talk like Audrey in As You Like It. There's no distinction, there's no idea that one prince might have a way of talking differently to another. The thing that comes in with the novel is, firstly, a sense that people can reinvent themselves in the world of this emerging capitalism. People can make their own way. They can also be shown to be quite different in nature, one from another, and the significance of their individuality is not to be underestimated. It doesn't matter that they're not characteristic of their social class. Nobody like Moll Flanders had ever lived before. She is Moll Flanders. She sounds like Moll Flanders. She doesn't behave remotely like anybody else in the book, or sound anyone else in the book. The other thing that comes in, I think, which is something that's very often overlooked in accounts of the novel, is a great pile of stuff. And the physical nature of the world, very often in literature before Robinson Crusoe, to use Robinson Crusoe as a useful terminal point, very often the stuff of the world is only kind of referred to by a work of literature if it serves a very specific plot function. So we know that Othello gives Desdemona a handkerchief. We know about the handkerchief, but because it's the means by which Iago fools him into believing that she's committed adultery. We don't know, on the other hand, what's in the rooms that they live in, what they're wearing, any of that, because it's not in the nature of literature before Robinson Crusoe. You come to Robinson Crusoe, and there are great paragraphs of the stuff that is on board a ship when he gets to, and this stuff, these things, they serve a proper They serve a proper but sort of meaningless function in that when Robinson Crusoe is on the desert island, he has to explain to the readers how bread is made, how a house is constructed. He makes some pretty strange things for himself. He makes an umbrella for himself. He makes a pair of spats rather wonderfully. And these things, the piling up of the inanimate objects, it goes a long way, I think Defoe discovered and demonstrated, to creating the sense of a real, convincing world. And Defoe's subsequent books did in part explore this kind of convincing documentary aspect of the pile of stuff. One of the reasons that people have always thought that one of his books of the 1720s, A Journal of the Plague Year, people have always suspected that he'd just found a manuscript from 1665, and just reported it, because it just feels so authentic. The reason it feels so authentic is that he went to a lot of trouble to fill it up with this and that, with what tables were like, with what the things sitting on tables, how people were buried, the grass growing between the cobblestones in the streets. That's something entirely new, and it comes in with the novel.
And in A Memoirs of a Cavalier, you kind of get that slow... The battle scenes in Europe are built up very, very, you know, slowly. And doesn't that also plays out in Robinson Crusoe in the attitude towards text within the novel, that there's this man scratching out marks each day of his in his confinement as a castaway, and then he undergoes a conversion experience, escapes, and then finally is able to write the full proper accounts of his adventures. Yes. The reader then can enjoy.
Yes, that's certainly something that one might put down to a certain amount of nervousness in the creation of a new genre of literature, explaining how this came to be, expressing kind of interests in the found document. But actually, that's something that people on the whole absolutely love, and readers absolutely love. And it sort of carries on in an extraordinary way into the 19th century novel, into the 20th century novel. People are always writing novels of the found document. And it seems to be a very kind of seductive thing for readers, which is unpredictable. You would have thought that if you're constantly being reminded that you're reading a found text, which contains, in some cases, references to another found text and so on, that would distance readers from the book that they're reading. But no, some of the most popular novels ever written, and a good example is a 1770s novel by Henry Mackenzie called The Man of Feeling, which is one of the most fragmentary novels of assembled texts you could imagine. Huge bestseller across Europe. Huge.
It even works when the narrator is name is a pun, like Mr. Utterson in Jekyll and Hyde. You know, it's sort of shoved in your face.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
But just to return to kind of the context of Defoe, and you show really elegantly, I think, that some of the novel grows out of these popular conduct books and spiritual autobiographies and criminal lives. Can you explain what format those took and how the novel begins to kind of escape beyond them?
Well, the standard academic explanation of the novel is that it grows out of prose romances. And the prose romance was a very sort of dignified form as far as readers were concerned. There was written by courtiers like Sir Philip Sidney for court readers. And so academics have a tendency to like that sort of thing. They like to demonstrate the dignity of what they're talking about by rooting it in another dignified form. It certainly didn't seem like that to contemporaries of Defoe. Pope puts Defoe in the Dunciad. For him, he was just a very bad writer. And the reason for that is that forms that his books are rooted in are very, very undignified genres. Lives of criminals, some of which were just sold on the street in a on a sheet of paper. Scandal, fiction derived from popular scandals. Like there's a series of novels actually by Aphra Behn about a scandal of the 1660s, abduction and adultery. They go back to conduct books, telling which are always thought of as being rather kind of undignified form, because of course if you were genuinely posh then you would know how to behave, you wouldn't need a conduct. But these are aimed at these, including the ones that Defoe wrote, these are aimed at people who are getting above themselves. There's also to a surprising degree the place of pornography. And there's a whole genre of memoirs of prostitutes in the 1690s Defoe's two novels narrated by women, Moll Flanders and The Fortunate Mistress, or Roxana as it's often called, clearly grow out of. Interestingly, it's demonstrable that these undignified genres had a wider readership than is sometimes taken for granted. For instance, one of the reasons that the pornographic narratives survive is that they're very eagerly collected by New England Puritans. There's a famous one, I forget his name now, that it comes from the collection of Increase Mather, Puritan divine in New England. Now, whether he was collecting them to keep under the bed, or whether, as he would probably have claimed, he was reading these things to find out about the different forms that sin could take, you know, who knows. But it is certainly a rag bag of undignified and often, you know, frankly embarrassing forms that the novel comes out of.
Following on from that, you know, I was going to ask sort of who was buying Defoe's books, and how did his readership change? At what price? How were the books actually sold? And how did that then in turn influence the way he wrote?
Who Defoe's readers were, it's quite difficult to know. Later in the century, we do see people starting to show an interest in Defoe's whole career. Dr. Johnson, of all people, I mean, he was a very kind of classically minded person, so it's surprising to see this. He thought of drawing up a list of all Defoe's works of imagination. We do know that they were hugely successful from the start. Robinson Crusoe must have made a good deal of money. The interesting and the crucial thing for the development of the novel is that it wouldn't have made a lot of money for Defoe himself, because at that point the copyright laws were not automatic. They were not really in favour of the authors, to the author's benefit. He would have sold Robinson Crusoe for a flat fee to a publisher, who then put it out into the world and mopped up the profit. The only way that Defoe could benefit from the success of Robinson Crusoe would be to write something else and sell it to another. Another bookseller, as they were called. They didn't call them publishers then. And actually, all Defoe's books of the 1720s are sold to different publishers. It's fascinating looking at the sequence of books that that Defoe wrote in the 1720s. You can see him trying to work out what had appealed to people in Robinson Crusoe. There's two sequels to Robinson Crusoe that nobody ever reads now, because they're just very, very dull, which are largely theological speculation. Defoe wondered whether that was why people liked him. There's a lot of theology in Robinson Crusoe. Maybe not. So he tried maybe writing something that that explored a remote and lost world through things. Journal of the Plague Year tried to exploit tales of exotic places, like Captain Jack, and tried to venture into the establishment of a really compelling narrative voice of a unique and brave and spirited person, Moll Flanders and the Fortunate Mistress. So by the end of Defoe's life, he has actually set the novel on a very firm basis. We can see in what survives what works better, and clearly what worked best. I would say that the three or four novels, I would say, let's say three novels, because the Journal of the Plague Year, I think, is a kind of unique endeavour. The three novels that work best are the novels that invest most in an individual voice and in establishing a personage that's very different from the author. So Moll Flanders and Roxana in the voice of women, you know, written by a man. The interesting question is, what did his initial readership think of them? Did they think that Moll Flanders was genuinely written by a woman? Would any of them have known or guessed that it was actually written by the same man that wrote Robinson Crusoe? We don't know. We don't really know.
The Guardian recently published a poll of 172 writers and critics on the 100 best novels of all
time.
Yes,
they didn't ask me.
I actually checked that you hadn't been asked.
No, they didn't ask me. Perhaps they thought I didn't know enough about the novel. I don't know.
But there was no Defoe, so none of the things we talked about. No, and no Richardson, no Swift, and no Fielding. And I think the 18th century is only represented by Tristram Shandy.
Yeah.
But why? What makes it kind of thrilling to read the work of novelists who maybe don't quite appear to be our own to the kind of contemporary critical elite, but actually have, if you're willing to go there, have so much to say to us?
Well, first of all, the first thing to say about lists of 100 greatest novelists is that it's massively an opportunity for people to signal their own virtue. I mean, if you went back to the 1930s, then Huckleberry Finn was routinely regarded as described as the greatest novel in the English language. A person now who put Huckleberry Finn on any list of theirs would be dicing with their own career. They wouldn't. They couldn't possibly. Similarly, I mean, you know, you're not going to get anybody to nominate Smollett's Humphrey Clinker, glorious novel, one of the most brilliant novels in the language. You know, forever afterwards, you'd be the person with a target on your back, the man who had said that Humphrey Clinker was one of his five favorite novels. What does the 18th century novel, I think that one of the things that is absolutely transfixing about the novel as a whole is the way that examples from anywhere and any time, they sort of ricochet between moments of utter strangeness and totally recognizable human truth that we utterly grasp. There's life as we know it, and then there's kind of strange remote life. I mean, there's to take an example from a famous novel. I remember the first novel by Jane Austen I read was Mansfield Park, and it took me a while to recognize the rule that a younger sister shouldn't marry before her older sister. And the rule is broken in Mansfield Park, and that's one of the problems with the family. that's a kind of remote and exotic thing, like a piece of behavior in the Tale of Genji or something. But then you just hit a line in a paragraph where, and I think it's my favorite line in all Jane Austen, and it's, I wish I could, I'm not going to be able to quote it accurately, but it's the moment when she talks about a wet Sunday afternoon when of all times the heart must be opened, and it's something about how if you're on just with a close friend on a wet Sunday afternoon, that's the moment when the heart is opened. And I just remember reading that and saying, oh yes, that was me and my mate Karen last Sunday afternoon. It's extraordinary. The great 18th century novels, there are extraordinary moments of recognition of humanity up against all sorts of bits of things that, you know, we just don't know about and can't recognize. One of my favorite it must be said that the appeal of novels to somebody who really loves novels is of the exact thing, the strangeness of behavior. There's one of my favorite 18th century novels is Mrs. Inchbald's A Simple Story. And the dilemma there, which is a young teenage ward of a Roman Catholic priest and nobleman, and they fall in love, and what are they going to have to surrender? It's absolutely alien. You know, it's never going to come into our lives in any form at all. But it's completely gripping because it explains it with such clarity, I think.
I certainly recognise that in Samuel Richardson's Clarissa, that it's an enormous epistolary novel where some of the letters you're kind of waiting for, trying to understand what constraints Clarissa is operating under. And some of it really, you're right, doesn't make immediate sense to us.
No.
And yet the overall effect can be absolutely gripping.
I think the constraints are the crucial thing. And I think actually being allowed as readers to override those constraints and hear Clarissa talking about her underwear in great detail. It's one of the things that really appealed to readers at the start and really appeals now. I mean, Clarissa isn't even the most extreme example. I'm probably the last man alive that not only read but really likes his last novel, Sir Charles Grandison. And my lord, the intricacy of strange behaviour there, it's absolutely glorious, I think.
Just before we talk about Jane Austen, I mean, how much does, we talked a little bit about copyright, but how much does copyright do for the novel?
Copyright has an enormous impact on the novel and the way it shapes careers. There's a number of examples. The 1774 copyright ruling, which enabled publishers to put forgotten classics back into print with much more ease. Before that, the original copyright owner could sit on a text and do nothing with it for years. After 1774, it was much easier to bring out editions of old works. And from that point onwards, you can see that practicing novelists become much more aware of the history of their own form. And the reason that they become more aware is that publishers after that start being able to bring out lovely, long, multi-volume collections of classics. The first, very soon after 1774 ruling, in the Gentleman's Magazine, 35 or 40 classic novels. That puts the form of the novel on a much more dignified footing, And you can actually see that novelists become, in a way, much more technically resourceful, I think. Fanny Burney, for instance, who starts publishing in the 1780s, is a very technically resourceful novelist and can draw on all sorts of different practices in the past which just weren't there before. We also see novelists actually consciously learning from their predecessors. We know that William Godwin, who wrote the best of all Gothic novels, in the first edition it's called Things as They Are, subsequently Caleb Williams, we know that he was reading Defoe, and there are pastiches of a Defoe title page in Caleb Williams. There are other instances when changes in copyright certainly had a big effect. One might be the extension of copyright after an author's death at the beginning of the 20th century. And at that point, we start to see the extraordinary situation of novelists writing a novel with the express condition that it not be published until after they died. Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh wasn't published until after he died. Ian Forster's Morris, not until he died in 60 years after it was written. An extraordinary way. The changes in copyright fundamentally lead to a distinction between, in the 1720s, a novelist who'd had a big success was likely to write six or seven novels in the same vein in the decade afterwards. In the world that we live in, a novelist who's had a big success might very well sit back and never write another novel, like Harper Lee. It's hard to argue that that novelists shouldn't benefit from the success of their utterances, but certainly, you know, some very successful novelists just want to go on writing, you know, but there are novelists for whom a huge success leads to an end of their endeavours. So it does have a very strong impact on the practice of fiction.
To introduce another kind of concrete example, what would Jane Austen have been reading when she was a young woman, and how would she have actually got hold of it?
She would have got hold of it through circulating libraries. Circulating libraries, you paid an annual fee, and then you could borrow whatever you wanted. We know that she was a member of some circulating libraries in Chawton and in Bath. We also know that in some cases, when she knew that she really loved a book, she would have bought it. A novel by Fanny Burney, her third novel, Camilla, was published in rather an unusual way, by subscription. So people would have written in and said, put my name down for this, I can't remember how much it was, here's half a guinea or a guinea, and they got sent it. That would have been rather a posh thing to do, and Fanny Burney did it in, I suspect, because she'd held a position at court. It was something that other writers, novelists who'd worked at court, did. And we know that Jane Austen was one of the subscribers to Camilla, because her name appears on the list. This is in the early 1790s, so, you know, there was no kudos to be had out of this kind of this young woman in Hampshire, but mostly almost certainly she would have borrowed books from the circulating library. Books were just too expensive, really, to lay out on.
Before we actually come back to the kind of lending library, you talk about Austen as one of the first novelists who's really our own.
Yes.
Why do you think that?
It's a difficult one to answer, actually. It's a good question, but I think there is no doubt that the other novelists before Jane Austen, they're admired. They have people who love them here and there, but there isn't that sort of degree of massive, even naive adoration that we find in readers of Jane Austen. There were lots of stories, some rather snobbish in tone, of when the 1990s BBC Pride and Prejudice came out. There was supposed to be a woman who phoned up the BBC after episode 5, and she had to go on holiday the next week, and she wanted to know, please tell me, do Darcy and Elizabeth get together? And I love that. I think that's the sort of reaction that novelists ought to get among some, at least, of their readers. But it's difficult to imagine anyone having that reaction anymore to Fielding or Richardson. It is something that comes back, really, with Jane Austen, that degree of unmediated love. Why is it? I think perhaps it lies in the really unprecedented degree to which Jane Austen's people are distinct from each other. There have been computer-driven studies of the language used by each of Jane Austen's characters, and it's been demonstrated without any doubt that they sound completely different to each other, not just in ways of using particular vocabulary, like Mrs. Elton saying caro sposo, but in quite tiny things like how often they use the word the. It's extraordinary. And you can definitely associate with individuals in the novels to such a degree that you start to feel you can disagree with the novel about whether you would like them or not. For instance, I've always thought I'd much rather go in Emma. I'd much rather go out for dinner with Mrs. Elton than with Mr. Knightley and Emma's father. I mean, God, they must have been boring. But the degree to which that's been created is a consequence of the way in which you can walk round the characters. You can have imaginary conversations with them. You can imagine, you can reimagine the books from a completely different point of view, as, you know, people have done. People, I think probably somebody or other has rewritten Pride and Prejudice from the point of view of every single one of the other characters. There's one about the dull middle sister who's always quoting Fordyce's sermons. But I think somebody wrote a version from the point of view of Charlotte Lucas. That's a new thing, that degree of warmth and humanity and roundedness, and that will always survive, I think.
Even as you're speaking, I can remember dimly how each Bennet sister sort of sounds in my head, and why they all do have completely different feel and sense. So I very much agree.
The interesting comparison with Pride and Prejudice, she wrote it in the late 1790s. And she would have written it just after reading Fanny Burney's Camilla, which she was a subscriber to, as I said. And Camilla is also about a group of young women in a family. They start a bit younger than the Bennet sisters. And putting the two of them together, you can see that There's something of the excitement of disagreement and this lovely atmosphere in Camilla, but Fanny Burney doesn't go anywhere near as far distinguishing them one from another. And it's very nice to imagine Jane Austen finishing Camilla and saying, well, yes, I enjoyed that, but if I were to write that novel...
To go from Jane Austen, someone everyone will know about, even if they haven't read the novels, to someone who... a man who most of us will never have heard of and yet had seemingly a big influence on the novel. Why did... Explain to us why Charles Edward Moody is such an important and sort of baleful character.
Yes, he's... I say in the book that the novel has the story of the novel has villains as well as heroes, and Moody is my villain, really. Well... I mean, it's quite unfair because, you know, Moody no doubt, you know, made it possible for people to read a lot more novels than they would. He was the proprietor of a subscription library that started in the 1840s. He was enormously successful. He had a huge premises on Oxford Street. He would send his books for loan anywhere in the country or indeed overseas. He was fantastically reliable. He supported the publishing of fiction by committing to buy most new publications. That's to put it in a positive way. Though a couple of things that had rather a bad long-term effect between 1840s and the 1890s. Firstly, he had a strong preference for novels to be published in three volumes. That really was so that he could lend a single novel out to three times as many people. And because he committed to buy a reasonable number of copies, maybe 750 copies of a three-volume novel, publishers saw no reason really to chase a popular readership with their initial publication. It could go into cheap editions subsequently, but the first apparition of a novel would have been mostly for ambitious novelists in three volumes. They saw no reason to try and lower the cost of the three-volume novel, even though printing costs and paper costs and the taxation on publications were all lowering very considerably throughout the century. So the price of the three-volume novel stuck at a guinea and a half from 1821, when it was set by a novel, a hugely popular novel by Walter Scott, all the way through to 1894. And that, for much of it, would have meant between the equivalent of £200 or £300. Literally nobody bought the three-volume novel on its first appearance. They would have borrowed it from Moody's if they were among Moody's 30,000 supplier customers, or they would have waited for the cheap edition in between a year and 5 years' time. The other thing that had a very strong impact on the novel, in my view, is that Moody was rather a religious man, and he had a very strong idea that novels should not contain too much in the way of disreputable or immoral behaviour. It's very striking that if you look at the French novel in the second half of the 19th century, even if you look at the American novel in the second half of the 19th century, there's a lot of discussion of sexual morality, of adultery. In the English novel, that's hardly there at all. Nobody in Nobody in Middlemarch, for instance, is allowed to commit adultery. You can see that they can fall under the suspicion of flirting with each other too much, but it has to be shown very promptly to be baseless. People don't commit adultery in the English novel between 1860 and 1890. They very often commit bigamy, however, which is mysteriously more permitted. When the three-volume novel collapsed in 1894, when Mudie said he wasn't going to buy them anymore, firstly, all sorts of things happened to the novel overnight. Firstly, the price of the novel dropped from a guinea and a half to 6 shillings on initial publication. Secondly, all sorts of areas of human behaviour, which had been perfectly admissible in, for instance, Victorian newspapers, you could write about, you know, sexual congress between men in the 1860s on page 3 of the Daily Telegraph, not in a novel. Suddenly, in 1894, that rule disappeared, and we have all sorts of an explosion of topics of adultery, of saucy behaviour, of outbreaks of violence, of exotic settings, of all sorts of things that were just being kept under. And it's a prime example of how a powerful patron can influence not just the subject matter of a novel's or what can be identified as good quality literature, but actually the way in which it's published and the way in which it reaches its readership. There were huge readerships to be had all through Mudie's period. In the 1840s, there were penny serials. There's one by G.W.M. Reynolds called The Mysteries of London, which is probably the best-selling novel of the whole 19th century. It sold for a penny an issue and it was bought by 300,000 people upwards. And how many individuals read those copies, who knows? Yeah, that's at least 10 times the numbers of subscribers to Mudie's. The readership was just not being reached for those decades.
There are two things there. I mean, there are many scenes between Will Ladislaw and Dorothea Brooke in Middlemarch that make a lot more sense. And the way they interact with each other makes more sense when you know that. And two, I remember first reading, when I first read Great Expectations, I didn't know it was in three volumes. And I remember getting to the end of the first volume and thinking, oh, well, I'm going to go and have a cup of coffee now. You know, it's telling me to have a break. And it works quite well in Great Expectations for various reasons about the structure of the novel. What did Charles Dickens open up for novelists who came after him?
Well, Dickens is not necessarily a very good example of the three-volume novel. His initial means of publication was serialization, either in independent parts for most of his novels. They were, you know, he was so popular and so successful from the start, he could just bring out a novel with no, you know, nothing else to sell it. And he could sell 50,000 copies of an episode like Nicholas and Nickleby. Even a supposedly less successful novel like Martin Chuzzlewit sold, I think, 21,000, which is three times what Vanity Fair sold. There are any number of things that Dickens brought to the novel aesthetically. What did he bring in business or publishing terms? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I think he demonstrated just how many people could be reached and how the novel could move away from mere kind of lightweight entertainment, firstly into quite kind of challenging aesthetic areas. In Bleak House, that he described wonderfully as he wanted to express a romantic view of familiar things. That's someone recognizing that he's done something very strange in a book. But also, I think he demonstrated that a novel could, in between all the kind of entertainment and fun stuff, it could make a proper political argument. Now, it works very well in Dickens, because he was Dickens, and you know, you can ignore a lot of that. He certainly created the desire in a lot of not such talented novelists to descend to political arguments, but not have quite so much energy about it.
And in that period, how much does the British novel communicate with novels written in Europe? It seems like quite a kind of fragmentary. Yes. Complex relationship.
Yeah. Well, it depends, I think, on the individual novelist and whether they could speak that language. Remember that Mudie's Diktat would have ruled out a lot of French novels being translated. Madame Bovary wasn't translated for 30 years after it came out. I don't think the Red and the Black was translated until the 20th century. So, I mean, people were aware of it. People did speak foreign languages, and you can certainly trace a lot of kind of interest and excitement in individual novelists. Meredith, for instance, George Meredith reviewed Madame Bovary in French when it came out. He knew all about what the French novel was doing. Later in the century, George Moore, great novelist, I think, lived in Paris for some decades, a great friend of Manet, knew all about what the French realists were doing. Another individual case, I think, is Carlyle, who in Sartor Resartus writes the closest thing in English to the German novels of Jean-Paul Richter. They're very, very strange novels. There's not many books like those in world literature. And he learned from them. I think often the awareness of these novels, they crop up in very unexpected places. Sherlock Holmes, actually, at one point, asks Dr. Johnson whether he's read Jean-Paul, and Dr. Watson says that he's read Carlyle, who he understands is a bit like him. And there's a little paragraph when Sherlock Holmes sings the praises of Jean-Paul Friedrich Richter, which is not what you would expect. I wonder. I think we have to accept that there are areas of great ignorance among British writers as a whole. They're more flashes of enlightenment than anything else. In the other direction, of course, British novels were read all over the world. There were continental publishers like Tauchnitz who specialized in producing cheap editions in English for the continent to read. In my book, I talk for a few pages about the British novel in India. And the way in which the spread of circulating libraries created a readership among Indian language novelists from which they could create an art form of their own. I don't claim that as my independent research. There's an absolutely marvelous book by a historian called Priya Joshi about the English language novel in India, which I recommend to everybody.
I liked how, well, it's something I'm going to follow up on, is bit where you talk about Proust's admiration for George Eliot, and that his the aunts in the in Combray are directly influenced by characters in Middle on the Floss, which I haven't read. And that makes me sort of, it's like these sort of, I think that's what's quite nice about the sort of exploring a canon, is sort of working out resonances which you did not expect and surprise you. And now I'm going to go and read Middle on the Floss and see how that makes me
feel. Well, yes. I mean, that's a rare example of a foreign novelist liking a British novel that is actually a good novel. I mean, Proust was mad keen on George Eliot, and actually, the second volume of the cycle, the girls on the beach. It is wonderfully taken from the sort of aimless bickering of that you find in George Eliot. Proust also liked some terrible English books, absolutely terrible English books. And you know, there are Italian novelists who are deeply post-war novelists who are deeply influenced by A.J. Cronin. You know, he was a big kind of cult for A.J. Cronin. Conversely, some of the most sophisticated novelists in English, when their idea of an interesting foreign novelist, sometimes it's absolutely terrible. There's a wonderful book about Henry James's sources. Oh my lord, he liked some bad books. There's a French scandalous novelist called Gyp, and he read all Gyp's books, and they're so bad. I read three of them with mounting incredulity. Clearly, Henry James got something out of them. You can see that The Awkward Age is quite like Gyp's awful nonsense.
There's a lot of that even now, I often think, when writers signal that they've read certain elements of foreign literature. It can be really quite alarming what's kind of selected. And a bit strange. I liked your point that you draw out where about the kind of experimental literature of the 20th century, a lot of stuff's already been tried out in the 19th. I guess that gets us onto modernism and what you believe modernism was. Was it actually that modern?
It's a tricky one. My quarrel is not with modernism, but with proponents of modernism. There's a moment in the book, for instance, when an advocate of Furbank called Ernest Jones focuses on Furbank and First World War, early 1920s novelists of experimental tendency. And Jones focuses on on scenes in which somebody goes to a party and there's a sequence of unascribed conversational tags, something like, so I saw your sister the other day. Another drink? It's raining, isn't it? I'm making this up, you know. And he said, this has never been done before. Well, in fact, it had been done for years. It started, as far as I know, with a novelist of fox hunting in the 1830s, Robert Surtees. Great novelist, very, very innovative in technique, but he wrote about the upper classes and fox hunting. So subject matter sort of seems to rule him out. Similarly, the big innovation of the modernists, what after 1915 was called stream of consciousness, of going into somebody's head in an unmediated way. You can find that in some form in George Moore in the 1880s and 1890s, in Dickens, the death of Quilp, for instance, in The Old Curiosity Shop, is an absolutely absolutely unmediated flow of thought. Probably you can find it in any number of things. On the other hand, they did do it on a much larger scale. There's no doubt about it. There's no mistaking the stream of consciousness in a chapter of Ulysses for the chain of thoughts in Meredith or George Moore. On the other hand, it must be said that some of the things that they did that are most extreme innovations, you have to say after, well, that was interesting, but it wasn't worth it. The return of the gap between how people think and talk and how the novel describes them in highly elaborate styles. This is something you see in Wyndham Lewis, for instance. I think that's just not a helpful return to a piece of practice to return to. Similarly, though, I'm alone in this. I think that if you have a novel which consists of the unbroken and undifferentiated monologues of six different characters, this is Virginia Woolf's The Waves, with no dialogue at all, nothing to tell them apart, I think what you mostly demonstrate is that novels need the exact opposite. I absolutely detest The Waves. I don't mind saying so, but I know that most people think it's a great masterpiece. So, you know, you can disagree with me on that one.
Is that why, for example, if we address a writer like P.G. Woodhouse, he never really talks about as a master of invention or a dancer of style and form. It's often about the settings, the country house, the Edwardian, the green lawns of Edwardian England.
But they're sheer linguistic fantasy. The terms in which the terms in which they're described, the metaphors for emotional states or events, like there was a noise like G.K. Chesterton falling on a sheet of tin. They're exactly the same as the expanded metaphors in late Henry James. They're always regarded as very, very challenging. I think when Madeline Bassett says to Bertie, "Oh, Bertie," Bertie just says, "I'm just a sensitive plant." And Madeline Bassett says, "Oh, Bertie, you know you're Shelley." And Bertie says, "Am I?" Well, that's a joke about syntax, And observations about syntax are core modernist territory. All sorts of innovations that are customarily regarded as the property of high literature actually turn out to be flourishing in all sorts of things. Another example is the arrival of the unreliable narrator, which is always kind of the example that's always quoted. Is Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier. But in fact, most unreliable narrators of the time are in light classic comic fiction, like The Diary of a Nobody, or novel by Henry Bashford called Augustus Carp, the autobiography of a really good man. There's no reason why technical innovations shouldn't be most expertly displayed in not very dignified or elevated literary forms.
Absolutely. I guess we're getting to the final stage of the kind of the economic history of the novel. Paperbacks. What does the mass market for paperbacks do to the novel? Does it allow novelists to genuinely kind of follow their own instincts, or are there kind of new constraints that emerge?
Well, the major innovation here was Alan Lane's introduction of Penguins in 1935. And It took the industry by complete surprise, because it had always been assumed that there was a lower price limit that couldn't be exceeded, and it was largely regarded as eightpence. Alan Lane introduced paperbacks as at sixpence. Now, to sell...
So that's why, yeah, like Benn Brothers or Ernest Benn Limited do a nine penny novels.
Yes.
It's quite a limited...
Yes. Tony Benn's uncle, Ernest Benn, wrote a book called Confessions of a Capitalist, and he did all the calculations before Alan Lane, in which he assumed that a cheap reprint edition would have to be priced at a ninepence or eightpence, I forget which. And he just didn't think that sixpence was even worth considering. To make money out of sixpence novels, firstly, they couldn't be very recent books. They had to have been exhausted in their first readership. The first Penguins, I think the most recent one was 8 years old. And you had to sell an enormous number of copies. I think probably you wouldn't see any significant income till you hit 50,000 copies sold. So it does shift the thoughts of a novelist if his or her idea of a successful novel is not as it had been 80 years before, you know, Mudie's buying 750 copies, but a mass readership in 5 years' time selling, buying 50 or 100,000 copies and going on buying those 50 or 100,000 copies. It's a tricky one, really. The thing that we have to be enormously grateful to Alan Lane for is that he was firmly of the view that these books that he was issuing new editions of, they should be good quality novels. People had tried before to issue very cheap paperback novels with low production values. But they had always issued cheap editions of terrible novels. Somebody had tried to do a cheap edition of the novels of Ethel M. Dell in the First World War, and it hadn't worked, because to hold a sixpence copy of a novel by Ethel M. Dell would have proclaimed you as a member of a certain social class. Now, from Alan Lane, as soon as Alan Lane started, novelists like Graham Greene started appearing in Penguin. Evelyn Waugh started appearing in Penguin. All sorts of Hemingway was in the very first batch. It didn't indicate anything at all about your standing as a reader or as a human being that you were carrying a sixpence Penguin. That, I think, is the real triumph of it.
Part of the joy of your book, I found, was coming across writers I kind of knew fairly well, and I was constantly waiting for your judgment on them or what you're going to say.
You don't have to agree with it.
No, exactly. It was kind of thrilling waiting for your own view. But that what it made me really aware of is that there are really untold riches in the history of the novel in Britain that no lay reader, ordinary reader, or even someone who's read quite a lot will know at all. Which authors would you most like to see revived?
George Moore. I think the novel that I've given to more people who have asked me this question since they knew I was writing a history is George Moore's Esther Waters. And it's the life of a very simple servant girl told with such refinement and elegance and human sympathy, and it's absolutely joyous novel. There's actually a film of it with Dirk Bogarde in it, which I've rather made a point of not watching, but there you go. The other novelist who I think is severely underrated is Arnold Bennett. And The Old Wives' Tale, I think, is one of the truly great novels in English. There are other novelists that I personally adore, but I'm not totally convinced that I'm going to persuade everybody of them. I mentioned Surtees earlier. I think he's the great early Victorian novelist of social mobility.
What would you like to see done to preserve the past of the novel? And, you know, should the job just be left to secondhand marketplaces like Abe Books, or can we do something more ambitious?
Well, I've proposed that something that that public authorities could do is to support a proper library of the British novel. By library, I don't mean a building, but a collection of books. There's a great enterprise in America, the Library of America. There are the Pléiade editions in France, and they actually produce the collected works of individual novelists in a reliable and affordable, just about, form. I think that it's such a kind of lively and much loved part of national life that it's sort of been left to look after itself. I think that no longer quite works. And one of the things that public funding could do is to move away from giving grants to totally talentless and unpromising writers of today who ought to find their place in the marketplace, and towards funding a library of perhaps 250 of the most significant novelists of the British tradition, from Aphra Behn all up to Penelope Fitzgerald. What I think it would be a sort of parallel to the way after the Second World War, Nicholas Pevsner travelled through Britain making a detailed catalogue of historic buildings of the country. And just actually the fact of them being recorded and being available made an enormous difference to the way that this country preserved its traditions. It's vital, I think, that the traditions of the great novelists be preserved in a similar way. The other thing that the existence of a library of Britain would do would be to justify people going and taking literature degrees. If they had a bit of expertise in textual bibliography, then they could prepare editions, and that would be genuinely a useful thing to do.
Well, here's to genuinely useful activities.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for coming on, Philip. That was fascinating. And I thoroughly enjoyed the book, so thank you.
Thank you, Alistair.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.